Hey, welcome everybody. Good morning. It's about 2:31 and it is March 23rd. Is that right? Yeah, March 23rd. Okay, there are practicums this week. This is the last week before spring break. And it looks like everything is being recorded just fine. I'll get some of these lights turned down. That one. That one. That one. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule on the right-hand side. Like I said, practicums this week, so the 8 o'clock lab is done, then the 12:55 has got one, and then on Wednesday, the Wednesday groups have their practicums, and then next week is spring break. All right, so we're going to get into central nervous system today, later this week, peripheral nervous system, and then autonomic nervous system after we come back from spring break. Then there is one more week after that, and here is our third exam. These are the chapters on the third exam, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And that's going to be on April 20th. That's a Monday. It just so happens that is a week that we have our third practicum scheduled. So the Monday lab classes, we'll get a lecture exam and a lab practicum on the same day. Nope, not Wednesday, but only the Monday group, right? The Monday group will get a practicum on the same day. And that just means that the Wednesday lab will get a practicum on the fourth practicum, on the lecture exam and a practicum on the same day. Okay, so let's see. Today's the 23rd, so one, two, three. Is that right? One, two, three. 3 weeks away. The exam is 3 weeks away. Okay, and your next practicum is 3 weeks away as well. All right, anybody have a question on the syllabus at all? No schedule? That's all okay? All right, so I told my lab this morning that it's 4 weeks away. It's not. It's only 3 weeks away. Right there. All right, so don't get caught short. Here is the Wednesday lab that gets a lecture exam and the fourth practicum on the same day. All right, we were talking about the nervous system, generally speaking, last time. And does anybody have any questions regarding the nervous system, central nervous system? Labeled. I mean, anything with the peripheral nervous system? No? Okay. I hear some talking back there, so hold on, you guys. Don't disturb anybody. And let's finish up this particular chapter. So remember all these different divisions. If we have the complete nervous system, right, we can break it down into central and peripheral. Central, you can break down into brain and spinal cord, and everything outside the brain and spinal cord is what we call peripheral nervous system. Furthermore, you can break down the peripheral nervous system into some important components as well. And what are those? Well, we have a division that takes care of our body, and we don't have to think about it. And that's called the autonomic nervous system. All right, but let's go back to this row right here. Peripheral nervous system can be broken down into two kinds. The part that brings information into the central nervous system, we're going to call that sensory, bringing information in, like information from your eyes to your brain, and we call that afferent. So afferent and sensory are exactly the same thing. The other division is motor or efferent. This is going to take information from the brain out to the periphery. And when it does, it's going to bring this information to what we call effector organs. Effector organs. And so let's talk about some of those effector organs. We can classify them as either belonging to the somatic nervous system or autonomic nervous system. If it's somatic, that's skeletal muscle. So what kind of control is skeletal muscle under? Yeah, it's voluntary. You can cause a muscle to contract by willingness to contract or relax. Right, as opposed to other kinds of muscles in your body that you cannot control. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. And then there are other things that you can't control either, whether you're going to sweat or not. Those would be glands. Right? So I think you probably want to write down what the effector organs are for these two different nervous systems. For somatic, it is skeletal muscle in particular. And for autonomic, it is smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, and there's no particular order that you have to list those. Right? So you could say cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, or glands, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle. Doesn't matter. All right, so the peripheral nervous system broken down into sensory or motor. Motor, we can break down somatic, autonomic, and autonomic, we can break down into two divisions. All right, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And when we get to peripheral nervous system, we'll describe these things. All right, and sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system being part of the autonomic nervous system control most things in your body except for one thing. And autonomic means you don't have to control things with your conscious mind. It just automatically takes care of itself. Even when you're sleeping, the brain is working, making sure everything's working right. Okay, so what is one thing that the autonomic nervous system does not control? There's only one thing in your body. And that would be in the somatic nervous system, skeletal muscle. So all the things in your body, all the muscles, all the glands in your body, only skeletal muscle is controlled by your voluntary thought. All right? Everything else is controlled by your autonomic nervous system. Okay, so sympathetic. So here are the effector organs, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And there's a special relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. And it's the relationship between that we've seen between the biceps brachii and triceps brachii. How would you describe the relationship between biceps and triceps brachii? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other. So these two nervous systems, most of the time, or almost all the time, are antagonistic to each other. So if one is excitatory, the other is inhibitory. Or if one is inhibitory, then the other is excitatory. You can't really tell which one is which, but I'll give you some rules to help figure that out so you don't have to memorize everything. All right, so for the next couple chapters, whatever we look at, I want you to place on this diagram and be familiar with some of the concepts in that particular chapter. All right, so I think we were down over here talking about some electrical properties. We talked about a synapse, and then we started talking about some electrical properties of a neuron. And remember, a neuron is specialized to send nerve impulses very rapidly over long distances. That's its main job, not for contraction. All right, and the electrical property that I want you to be a little bit familiar with, it's in your notes, but I'm going to simplify it a little bit more, is called an action potential. Action potential, and potential just sort of means voltage. Every cell in your body acts like a battery. We're very electrical beings, so if we stick our finger in an electrical socket, we definitely feel it, and it changes our physiology, causes muscles to contract. All right, so action just means what? Something's changing, right? And potential means voltage, so that just means that the voltage of this cell is changing. And there are two things that make an action potential. An action potential is due to the movement of sodium. This is an ion. Na stands for sodium. And the motion of another ion called potassium. Does anybody know the chemical symbol for potassium? K. Sounds strange, right? It should be P, but it can't be P because P is phosphorus. But so potassium is K. And it's an ion as well. That's what that little plus sign means. It's an electrolyte. Who's ever heard of an electrolyte before? Anybody ever familiar with electrolyte? Yeah, you get your electrolytes measured in the hospital and they draw blood all the time. Here are two important ones. All right, so these are the ones that are involved with an action potential because they're going to move across the membrane. So I want you to know action potential. I want you to know these two ions and which way they move for an action potential. All right, so sodium goes in the cell, potassium goes out. That's got those two phases, two parts to an action potential. So this is just going to be just a step of memorization for you because we won't be able to develop why that happens and what it looks like and all that kind of stuff, but I think you should be familiar with these ions and that when they move, they can create changes in electricity across the cell membrane. And this is the point that I wanted to get to, a nerve impulse. Right, nerve impulse, I guess I'll draw it here, really big. We've talked about nerve impulses, and we're going to talk about nerve impulses. So what the heck is a nerve impulse? Right, that's why I went over an action potential. A nerve impulse is an action potential in motion. Okay, an action potential moving down. And does anybody remember what the sending part of a neuron is? The sending part? The sending part is the axon. Okay, so nerve impulse is just an action potential moving down an axon that's carrying information. And what is an action potential made of? The movement of these two ions right here. Sodium going in the cell, potassium coming out. That changes the electrical properties of the cell, which is a way that a cell or a neuron can send information. All right, does anybody remember, besides neurons, what are some other kinds of cells that make up the nervous system? Yeah, glial cells or support cells. Right, so all neurons can send nerve impulses. Right, but support cells do not. They do other kinds of things, and we talked about that last time. Okay. Nice. All right, let's go to some definitions, some nervous system terms. We're going to be using these. Remember what a neuron looks like. Oh, I tell you what, I want to pull up what a neuron looks like. What does a neuron look like? Ah, here it is. I'll leave that on the slide over there for now. Okay. All right. Gray matter. This is going to be in the nervous system. Gray matter is a group or a cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Do you remember what a nerve cell body and a dendrite is? Here is the nerve cell body, and here are dendrites. And in our nervous system, they're not going to look yellow. They're going to look gray. As opposed to this axon right here is not going to look gray because it's covered with these white things, these Schwann cells. And so gray matter is made up of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. White matter is made up of myelinated axons. And there's going to be a group of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites in certain locations in our brain, and we're going to call that gray matter. There are going to be groupings of axons that are myelinated going someplace in your central nervous system, and we're going to call that white matter, gray and white matter. And you can just see that with your eye. You don't need any special kinds of equipment to see that. Central nervous system cortex. Where is the cortex of an organ? Anybody remember, where is the cortex? It is, let's use the right kind of anatomic term. It is superficial. Yeah, it's a superficial part of an organ. And so what could we call the superficial part of a bone? The superficial part of the bone would be the cortex. And remember, the kind of bone that you find on the cortex is what kind? What's another way that you could talk about that bone besides being cortical bone? It is compact, right? Very solid bone. It's not spongy bone. Where do you find spongy bone? Inside, right? And when we say inside, the deep part is what we call the medulla, right? Deep part of an organ is the medulla. All right, and it just so happens that the central nervous system cortex is gray matter, right? So if it's gray matter, what parts of a neuron do you find right there? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. That's right. Not really axons, because we would find that in white matter. And since we say cortex, we mean right on the surface of the brain. So when we look at a cross-section of a brain, we're going to see that the superficial parts are gray and the deeper parts are white. Okay, a nucleus. You know what a nucleus is from what we looked at in, when we talked about cells. All right, but in terms of nervous system, all right, it means something a little bit different. So here we have a neuron, right, just a single cell. Here is the nucleus inside the cell that's controlling all the activity of this neuron right here. But in terms of neuroanatomy, a nucleus is going to be gray matter in the central nervous system. And what's gray matter again? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So a whole bunch of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system is what we're going to call a nucleus, like the basal nuclei. I'll point some of those out to you. And a ganglion is the same thing, except in the peripheral nervous system. A group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system is going to be gray matter in the peripheral nervous system. We're going to call that a ganglion. So a nucleus is in the central nervous system. A ganglion is in the peripheral nervous system. All right, white matter, we talked about already just a little bit. What makes up white matter? Axons that are myelinated, right? And I guess that's kind of a little bit funny because only axons are myelinated. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites are never myelinated, right? Only axons are myelinated. That's white matter. A nerve tract is in the central nervous system, and it is just white matter. So what's another way of saying a nerve tract? What is it? It is myelinated axons in the central nervous system. There's something similar in the peripheral nervous system, right? White matter in the peripheral nervous system, we don't call that a tract, we call that a nerve. That's going to have a little bit different structure to it, a little bit more connective tissue, and it can even have its own blood supply. So when we say white matter, don't forget, myelinated axons going someplace. Now what about information down an axon? What about a nerve impulse? Can it move in two directions or only one direction? Only one direction. And is it a specific direction? Or what's the specific direction that it can go in? Down. Okay. Down where? From where? From the cell body. And as a matter of fact, or dendrites, because it's all non-myelinated. So nerve impulse, right, will come from the cell body down here and then will travel down all the way to the axon terminus, right? That's the only direction that it can go. We talked about when an axon is myelinated, it can send a nerve impulse in what kind of way? When it's a myelinated fiber. Because it costs some energy to put all these Schwann cells here. Why does our body put Schwann cells there? So the nerve impulse? Yeah, speeds up down this axon. It travels much faster, hundreds of miles faster per hour, hundreds of miles per hour faster. Right, so a nerve impulse, right, just skips from one node to the next, to the next, to the next. And as that nerve impulse is moving, what do we call that event that happens right here in that node of Ranvier? It's a special electrical event. And that's what I wrote on the board. It is an action potential. That's right. So here's an action potential here, and then it skips over here, another action potential, then over here's another action potential. All right, so if there's an action potential taking place right at this node, what's happening to sodium in this area of the node? Sodium is moving into the cell, right? And then after that, the second phase, what's going to happen? There's another electrolyte. Potassium is going to leave the cell, right? Okay. All right, so let's then, so when it's fast, we call that saltatory conduction. When it skips, when it's just continuous, we just call that, continuous conduction. All right, so we need to look at some, what does a nerve look like? Okay, so the nerve probably could remind you of some muscles. All right, so where do we find a nerve? Where do we find this kind of object that's been dissected away for us right here? Where do we find a nerve? What part of the nervous system? Yeah, only in the peripheral nervous system, not in the central nervous system. All right, so surrounding, look at all these axons right here. Surrounding all these bundles of axons is a connective tissue sheath. We don't have that in the central nervous system, but we do in peripheral. We call that the epineurium. Neurium, you should always think of nerve. Epi means on top of everything. Connective tissue. And then you see some structures surrounded by the epineurium. Do you see any structures inside? So this is the whole nerve right here. Do you see structures inside the nerve? Yeah, I see some things. Right, I see bundles of axons, bundles of axons. What do we call a bundle of something, like a bundle of nerve fibers? Yeah, fascicle. right? So these are nerve fascicles. And then do you see any structures inside of a fascicle? I see some structure, right? And those are the axons of neurons. And they look kind of thick because they're surrounded by Schwann cells. And on top of the Schwann cell is a connective tissue sheath that we call endoneurium. Okay. And as a matter of fact, there's a connective tissue sheath around every fascicle. We call that the perineurium. All right, so epi on top, endo in it at the bottom, and peri right smack in the middle or surrounding a fascicle. All right, and nerves require their own blood supply. Tracts in the brain do not, but nerves do. So here is a artery and a vein by these two different kinds of colors. So that's the arrangement. All right, so this particular nerve right here, this nerve, we're just looking at the axon, right? Does this conduct electrical impulses fast or slow? Fast. Can you see the Schwann cells on there? Exactly. Okay. All right, so that is the nerve. We talked about this neuronal organization already, but maybe I'll pull up a, do I have a slide of this? Yeah, talked about this slide before. I had you modify this slide. So what should this reflex start with always? A stimulus, right? So there's going to be some light. You could put an arrow right here and say light and call that the stimulus. And then your eye is the, what's next? Receptor, right? And then you have these nerve impulses entering the brain through what kind of nerve does that? Sensory or afferent. Then there are nerves inside the central nervous system that make sense of what these signals are. We call that the integration center. And then the integration center makes a decision on what to do, sends that out to the peripheral nervous system via a motor or efferent neuron, which goes to this thing right here. What is this thing right here? Okay. Probably had some good ideas there, but I didn't quite hear. What is this thing right here? Effector organ. Fantastic. Yeah, effector organ. Is that what I have right here? Really close. And what does an effector organ produce? A response. So what does a reflex or a response loop always start with? Stimulus. And what does it end in always? A response, right? And then you just got to remember these pieces on the inside. All right. So we just need to talk about some types of processing of neural information. Okay, kinds of ways of processing information. Okay. Here I see a bunch of neurons. Does anybody know what kind of neuron this is that I'm circling right here by its shape? Could you identify this neuron by its shape? This is? You got three choices. What are the three choices? Multipolar, bipolar, or pseudo-unipolar. And you got to remember some functions of these things. So multipolar is a motor neuron. We saw that in that response loop. Bipolar has to do with special senses like the eye. And the sensory neuron is a pseudo-unipolar neuron. So these right here are the multipolar kinds. Many dendrites, one long axon. Right, and so this would be a motor neuron or an association neuron inside the brain, one of those two conditions. All right, so what does a diverging circuit allow us to do? Well, it means that there is one neuron that carries information, like nerve impulses based on action potentials, and the axon bifurcates or splits, and I can see that it splits into three different routes, and so one, this first one neuron can excite three, right? And then here's another row of neurons, and each of these can excite two other neurons. All right, so just by the depolarization or just by the excitation of one neuron, we can end up with many neurons, right, carrying that same information or be excited. So that information just doesn't go to one place, but it goes to many places via multiple pathways, as we see right here, because these axons split or bifurcate. That's a diverging circuit. Converging circuit. Maybe I'll think of an example of a diverging circuit. A good diverging circuit would be, for instance, maybe you grab something that was hot, okay, and so some muscles are going to be excited to contract. So if you touch something hot, what do you think your hand should do? It should pull away, okay? What muscle in my arm pulled my hand away? Yeah, my biceps got stimulated to pull my hand away on the right side of my body, right? But a lot of times what happens on the other side of your body, right, you push away. So when you touch something hot, you pull away with one side, push away with the other, that gets you away from that damaging stimulus. Right, so not only do signals go to your right arm to move your hand away, but also signals go to your left arm to excite other muscles, right, to move your body away from that damaging stimulus. It all happens at the same time. All right, a converging circuit. We can see that there is a central neuron, and it receives information, in this case, from three other neurons. So we call that a converging circuit, because all of these action potentials end up, right, with this one neuron here. That's converging. And then this last one is what we call a reverberating circuit. This is really an interesting circuit. Let's take a look at it. So here is the first neuron. It's excited, passes on that information to the second, right? And then this passes it on to the third, and even the third passes it on to the fourth neuron. But as information goes past this third and fourth neuron, what else happens? It starts to go backwards because the axons are twisted around, and it excites this cell down below that first pathway that we were looking at, and then this neuron that's down below sends information back to the third and all the way back to the second neuron, stimulating them again. So this kind of circuit can operate for long periods of time, even just with one stimulus. We call that reverberating. Now, why might we want to have a reverberating circuit like that in our body? Okay, once you think about it, it will be pretty obvious. Okay, these kinds of neurons keep us awake during the day. We wake up in the morning, we stimulate this neuron, right, and all these other neurons get stimulated, and then they go back and re-stimulate these first neurons in this particular pathway, right, and that keeps you aroused, keeps you conscious. And when this neuron over here that I'm pointing at right now becomes fatigued, that's when you fall asleep. And that happens in a particular part of the brain. We're going to look at that. It's called the reticular activating system. If there's damage to this reverberating circuit, let's just say that this lower neuron right here was damaged for some reason, what would happen to somebody? Okay, they wouldn't be able to stay awake when that happens. And I actually know some people, some friends where that happens. Does anybody know what that's called? That is narcolepsy. And sometimes it's really hard to diagnose why it happened and where this little neuron is. It's really hard to treat. Most times you can't treat it. So when a person can fall asleep without their willingness to fall asleep, guess what happens to their driver's license? Yeah, it is revoked, right? Because somebody could be driving down the 405 freeway and then all of a sudden fall asleep, and then that would be terrible for that to happen. They would just crash into whatever in front of them. All right, so that is called narcolepsy when there's damage to this reverberating circuit. So that's a fun one to think about. Okay, I think we have another kind that's a convergent, divergent. All right, here is a response loop. What would we call this match right here? Yeah, stimulus. And then there's something in the finger right there that can detect this flame. That is that would be a receptor, right? A temperature receptor or pain receptor, maybe a nociceptor. And then that sends information via the afferent into the central nervous system. Here's that association neuron, right? And then this area sends information back down, nerve impulses through this motor neuron to an effector organ that withdraws that finger from that damaging stimulus. Okay. All right. Some other kinds of circuits. Okay, I don't have examples. If I find an example, I'll point them out to you. Those would be the serial processing and parallel processing of information. And I just don't see, maybe they took that out of your book. I'll look for that. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. All right, so remember, a reflex always starts with a stimulus, ends in a response. Nerves, right? Where do we find nerves? What part of your body do we find nerves? In the peripheral nervous system. What's the counterpart in the central nervous system called? Tract. Yeah, it's called a tract. And a tract and a nerve is just a group of axons, myelinated axons. And so what kind of matter is that going to be in the central nervous system, gray or white? That's going to be white matter. That's right. So if you ever see something white in the central nervous system, that's going to be a tract carrying information someplace. And if it's carrying information from the spinal cord all the way up to the cortex of the cerebrum, cerebral cortex, from something very low in your central nervous system, like spinal cord, to your brain, what kind of tract is that going to be? And as a matter of fact, you know the definitions for these things, never talked about it like this before. But if it's taking information from the spinal cord up to the brain, do you think that would be a motor tract or a sensory tract? Yeah, sensory tract, right? So that's what we call an afferent tract in the brain. If it's carrying information from the brain down into the spinal cord, that's going to be what kind of tract? A motor tract or an efferent tract. All right, then we know where all these things are. We're going to look at some of these things. There's a couple of them. All right, so that's it for nervous system. Just a general discussion of nervous system. So we're going to move on to the next one, which is central nervous system. All right, there's five general areas that make up the brain, and the brain is part of the central nervous system. What's the other part of central nervous system? Spinal cord. Okay. So the first one I want to talk about is called the brain stem. All right, so if you think of a stem on a plant, where the heck is it? Is it like on the tip of the plant? Or is it on the base of the plant? Yeah, the base, right? So brain stem just means the base of the brain. That's one really good way to think of it. And a picture where that I'm going to show you where some of the stuff is 14. Where's 14? 15. Right here. Okay, so here is a section through the central nervous system. I see a little bit of spinal cord over here, and everything above that is the brain. So here's the brain. And probably no one's ever looked at a brain before, so this is going to look really strange to you. But after you look at it a bunch of times, you'll become familiar with it. And it is an exam figure, and maybe I'll even have you label this thing in lab someday. Right? Maybe not this week or next week, but for the last lab series. So what kind of section is this? Does it look like to you? Nice sagittal section. And we see some things. And where would I want to start looking for the brain stem? Way up over here? Or down over here by the spinal cord? Down by the spinal cord. So here is the brain stem. And it's made of two main areas. It's called the pons and the medulla oblongata. So right above the spinal cord is the medulla oblongata. Right above that is the pons. So we're looking at this area. All right, so what's taking place in this area? Well, there are nuclei, there are areas of gray matter that control some very important things for you, like heart rate. And we call that the cardioregulatory center. So there are places in the medulla and pons that control your heart rate, how your heart contracts. Right? Also, vasoconstriction. It controls how blood vessels can constrict or dilate. For instance, if you're very hot, right, your skin might look a little red because those blood vessels are dilating, and that's controlled by the brainstem, the medulla. And when they dilate, it carries heat to the surface so that you can get rid of that heat. There's also a respiratory center. It's located between the pons and the medulla, involves both of these things, but even when you're sleeping, you don't have to think about breathing, right? Even though the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle and you can consciously control it, you can get it to stop, right? And I think I said we could all do this, but no one ever wanted to do it with me, right? We could all hold our breath until we pass out, right? That would be cool. Pass out. And as soon as we passed out, what would happen? We start breathing again because this respiratory center would take over, right? So that's just kind of automatic breathing. We don't call it autonomic because it's really under voluntary control. Respiratory center. And also swallowing, vomiting, coughing, sneezing. These are all controlled in this area over here as well, in the brainstem. A lot of times, or most times, well, in terms of sensory information, what you see on the right side of your visual field ends up on the left side of your brain. And what you see on the left visual field ends up on the right side of the brain. So it just so happens that signals cross over each other, and a lot of signals do that. Where they cross over, right, happens a lot of times on the medulla. And we can see some like cross hatches, right? And when you make these nice cross hatches, it forms triangles all over the place. And we call those pyramids, right? So pyramids are these longitudinal ridges on the ventral side of the medulla. What's the ventral side? Yeah, the front, anterior side, right? So they're going to be located in this area right here, right? And they carry motor tracts, right? And if I were to say cortical spinal, could you tell me that cortical spinal is a motor tract? Because just like when we name a muscle by its origin and insertion, that's exactly how we name a tract, where the signals come from and where they are going, where are the nerve pulses coming from. So where are in the cortical spinal tract, where are action potentials being generated? In the cortex, the cerebral cortex, and where are they going? Into the spinal cord. Yeah, so are these going to be efferent or afferent tracts? Efferent or afferent? Aha, here's a clue. Motor is efferent. Yeah, efferent. Okay. And we also know that to be efferent because it starts in the brain and then goes out the spinal cord, then into the periphery. I don't see any on this particular slide. And where these tracks cross over, right, we call that decussation of the pyramids. Decussation just means crossing over from one side of the brain to the other. That's where it happens. All right, the pons. Let's look at the pons. Pons is part of the midbrain as well, along with the medulla. It has an important function because it receives signals from sensory tracts, and it sends that information to the cerebellum. So I'm pointing at the cerebellum right now, right? And does the surface of the cerebellum look flat and smooth? No, it's got all these ridges on it, and these are really small ridges, right? So that's how you can tell this is the cerebellum and not some other part of the brain. So we say that the pons is a relay station for getting information into the cerebellum. I'll talk about the cerebellum by itself in just a little bit, but it's important for coordinating motion in your body, reflexes, so that you can walk with a normal gait. And if you trip, right, then the cerebellum here can activate various muscles right away so that you don't fall. So it has a whole bunch of like little computer subroutines. If you're an athlete, then you train the cerebellum, right, to develop what they call muscle memory. That happens here in the cerebellum. Okay, a midbrain, still part of the brain stem. Look down over here, midbrain. All right, so we got spinal cord, we got medulla, above that is the pons, and then the midbrain is just running across like this, from here to here, and then from about this region to this region right here. So it's kind of a short region. You see this little blue tunnel going through it? Just to give you some bearings. That tunnel is filled with cerebrospinal fluid, and it's moving around. We'll talk about its motion in a little bit. But if you see that, then you're in the midbrain. Right? And I see two bumps, right, on the posterior side of the midbrain. And there are two on one side, two on the other, so there's a total of four. These are what we call the corpora quadrigemina. Quadrigemina means four little bodies, corpora, little bodies, and these have some really interesting functions. Okay, here is the superior colliculus, here's the inferior colliculus. Right? To make a corpora quadrigemina, we need a superior and inferior colliculus on both sides of the brain. And the superior colliculus works with your eyes. So once you see an object in motion, it allows your eyes to fixate on that object and predict where it's going so that your eyes can follow it. Right, so this is a part of your brain that knows if an object is moving from right to left, right, or left to right, or from far away from you to close to you, right, or if it's moving up and down. It helps activate muscles so that it turns your eyeballs one way or the other, so that you can track something in space. Right, so I'm sure athletes have a really developed superior colliculus that can track like a baseball when it's hit. Because it doesn't go straight, it curves around quite a bit. Right, that's the superior colliculus for vision. The inferior colliculus is not for vision, but it's for hearing. We say that the inferior colliculus allows you to localize sound. Localize means you can tell where sound is coming from. All right, so does anybody know how many doors to this room we have? How many doors do we have? One, two in the front, two in the back. And with our eyes closed, if somebody were to open and close one of those doors, you would be able to tell if it is one in the back, right? And then furthermore, you could tell if it's the right or left one, or if it's one of the doors in the front, and again, on what side it is, right? And that would be the job of the inferior colliculus to do that. So it's for auditory localization, tell where sounds are coming from. All right, what do we call it with all four of these things put together? Two superior colliculi, two inferior colliculi, that would be the corpora quadrigemina, part of the midbrain. So this tunnel, it's on this slide, so I guess I'll tell you a little bit about it. This little tunnel that's carrying fluid, that fluid is called cerebrospinal fluid. Right? And that little tunnel is called the cerebral aqueduct. Right? Kind of named that way. I see some other chambers in the brain. We'll talk about these chambers in a little bit, but there's that cerebral aqueduct. All right, so that is, one last thing about the midbrain. Remember we talked about the reticular activating system or reticular formation, a bunch of nerves that forms a reverberating circuit. What's the job of that reverberating circuit, the reticular formation? It keeps you, keeps you awake. And it's located in the pons and the medulla. So if somebody has a stroke or damage to that area, then they can develop narcolepsy when that happens. That could be maybe one example why somebody has narcolepsy. Okay, the next part of the brain, the diencephalon. Diencephalon, I'm circling right now, kind of a smaller part of the brain, right through here. Still not quite up into the cerebral cortex. Cerebral cortex or cerebrum is up over here. All right, so we're working our way superior. If I look at this oval-shaped structure, this is what we call the thalamus. This is going to be a nice landmark for you in lab. And this little lobe of the brain, it's buried deep inside the brain, acts as a relay station for everything that is coming up the spinal cord. Okay, what kind of tracts are coming up from the spinal cord to the thalamus? What's the function of that kind of tract? Yeah, it's going to be sensory. Right, so the job of the thalamus is to take sensory information and direct it to the proper part of the brain so that you can experience that sensation. And we're going to learn what lobes of the brain do what. And I'll just tell you right now that here is one lobe of the cerebrum. And actually, you probably know the name of this lobe already, even though we haven't talked about it. Who could take a guess? What lobe of the brain does this look like right here? Indeed, it is. It is the occipital lobe. Right? So it's the job of the thalamus to take visual information, right, visual signals, and direct it to the occipital lobe. That's what it's job to do. It will also take signals from your ears, right, and send them to the temporal lobe. Here's the temporal lobe way back over here because that's where we have the auditory cortex. So the visual cortex is in the occipital lobe, auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. All right, well, the way that you perceive something is by the location, its location, where those action potentials go in the cerebral cortex. So if action potentials go to the occipital lobe, no matter where those action potentials originate, what is your perception if action potentials go to the occipital lobe? It would be vision. You'd see something, okay? So all depends. You know, we could just send electrical information there and you'll see something. It just might be like stars or patterns, right? It won't be something nice and visual. But what happens if we take that information from your eyes, let's say a nice square box, okay, that you would see with the occipital lobe, take that information and send it to the temporal lobe. Okay, what would happen? Temporal lobe is not responsible for vision, it's responsible for what? For hearing. Yeah, so if we take that exact same information and derail it from the occipital lobe and let it go to the temporal lobe, what would be somebody's experience then? Then they would hear something. When you look at something, a structure, then you would actually hear it because that's where those action potentials go. So your experience is determined by what parts of the cerebrum are activated by action potentials, right? And all action potentials are the same. It only depends on what part of the brain it goes to, and that's the job of the thalamus. So you think that's an important job? So that when you see something, you don't hear it, you don't taste it, you don't smell it, right? You actually see it. Okay, so that's the job of the thalamus. It's the relay station. There are two lobes, and there's a connection between the two lobes. We call that the interthalamic adhesion. So the right and left part of the thalamus can actually communicate with each other because there's a space, right, between the two lobes of the thalamus, and it's kind of shown in this blue color, filled with that fluid, cerebrospinal fluid. All right, another part of the diencephalon is below the thalamus, and you could probably tell me the name. It is the hypothalamus. Yeah, here's the hypothalamus, and there are nuclei in the hypothalamus that do some really important things. What the heck is a nucleus once again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Yeah, it forms a really specific network, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And each one of these nuclei, right, control temperature in your body by vasoconstricting or dilating blood vessels or by causing sweat glands to secrete sweat. It also gives you the sensation of hunger and thirst. All right, so if your body becomes dehydrated, there are sensors that can detect the saltiness of your body or the saltiness of blood. And if your blood gets too salty, guess what you feel? You feel thirsty, right? Because there are receptors here, called those osmoreceptors. And if blood glucose starts to go down, this is the center that gives you the sensation of being hungry. Okay, so temperature regulation, hunger and thirst. And the hypothalamus is located next to a very important endocrine gland, and here I see the endocrine gland. Here is the pituitary. Part of it is neuronal, part of it is just is part glandular tissue, right? And it's right below the hypothalamus, and the reason why I'm mentioning it, because the hypothalamus controls what the pituitary does. And the pituitary, a lot of people think of the pituitary as the master control endocrine gland. So the pituitary controls many other endocrine glands in your body, and then what controls the pituitary? The hypothalamus. Yeah, the hypothalamus. So when we get to the endocrine chapter, we're going to really look at this pituitary gland and the connection to the hypothalamus. And I see this little pathway here connecting the pituitary to the hypothalamus. I'm going to mention that. That's called the infundibulum. Infundibulum. It's not labeled on this slide, so it's not part of your labeling for this particular slide, but we're going to talk about that particular piece of tissue a lot in this class. All right, and then we have the cerebrum, which is, right, superior to the diencephalon. And if we look at the diencephalon, we see it here. If we look at the brainstem, it's right here. And then we have the cerebrum. How would you characterize the size of the cerebrum compared to the diencephalon or the brainstem? The cerebrum is what? Same size? A lot bigger, right? A lot bigger. Okay. And it's got a lot more stuff. So this is the largest part of the brain. And I'm looking right at the surface of the brain. We can look down from the top. There is a split in the brain. So here is really a surface. And that split is called a fissure. So there's a fissure that goes all the way down. And the surface of the brain, does it look flat and smooth, or does it look like it have wrinkles on it? It's all wrinkled up, right? These wrinkles are what we call convolutions, right? A convolution just means something has a twist and a turn in it, right? If somebody is talking to you in a convoluted way, it's hard to follow what they're saying because they're like talking about maybe different things at the same time or confusing things, right? So a convolution has a lot of twists and turns. And a convolution has two parts. And I see basically two different kinds of colors. Right. And this lighter color right here is a raised area on the surface of a brain. And this darker area here represents a depression. Right. So what do we call a depression or a groove in anatomy? A sulcus, that's right. So these dark areas right here are sulci, they're depressions. And then on either side of that sulcus is going to be something we call a gyrus. Right? So if you put a gyrus and a sulcus together, guess what you get? You get convolutions. So the surface of the brain is highly convoluted, right? Because of all these gyri and sulci. And they all have different names. We're going to name a couple of them, a couple of sulci, not too many, but a couple of them. All right. And on the surface of the brain, in these gyri right here, that's where we have gray matter, nerve cell bodies, and dendrites, figuring out what to do for us. All right, so let's look at some areas. So the most anterior part of the brain, we call that the frontal lobe, right? It's just deep to the frontal bone. And then posterior to the frontal lobe is going to be the parietal, right? Because the parietal bone is right there. And then posterior to the parietal lobe is the occipital lobe. All right, so on this view, you can't really see a difference between parietal and frontal lobe, but I'll give you another view in just a little bit. And then if we were to rotate this brain around, we see another lobe over here. All right, so what bone is this up against? Yeah, this is the temporal lobe. Okay, and all these different lobes have different kinds of functions. Let's talk about this frontal lobe first. Where do you have the motor in your automobile? Who's got a motor in your automobile? Anybody have a car with a motor in it? Where do you find the motor? In the front or the back? Front. Anybody else have one in another place? Back. Anybody want to have in the back? Most of those cars are gone, rusted away. Anybody have a motor in the middle of their car? No? Those are real expensive. I see them every once in a while. Okay, so motors usually are in the front of the automobile. And the reason why I mention that is because I want you to, I was looking for another picture. Okay, I'll go back to this original one. Okay, this is where motor signals originate. Now, what is a motor signal? A somatic motor signal. What is it? What kind of effector organ does it go to? Well, first, do you believe me that a motor signal goes to an effector organ? Yeah, that's the definition of a motor nerve fiber. Okay, and so what is the class of effector organs? Skeletal muscle, right? So this frontal lobe, right in this area here, is responsible for controlling motor functions in your body, right? Your skeletal muscles. And we're going to see a really interesting map on how that happens. All right, so just think, frontal lobe is important for motor functions. There's a special area that controls your lips and breathing and tongue motions for speech in particular. And that's called Broca's area. That's a motor area for speech. Remember we said the temporal lobe in passing, you haven't studied this, but the temporal lobe, I gave you one example of its function for hearing. That's right. All right, so language is part speaking and part hearing. And if there's damage to the frontal lobe, it's absolutely possible that somebody understands speech completely, but they can't respond because there's damage to the motor area in the brain, right? And the converse is true, right? If there's damage to the auditory part, somebody can speak just perfectly, but they can't really hear what they're saying, right? Or hear what you're saying. And if they grew up that way, then sometimes it's really difficult to learn pronunciation and how vowels and consonants are formed, right? Because you don't really hear what they sound like. Okay, so the motor area for speech is Broca's area. The basal nuclei. Your book calls them basal ganglia. What do we know what a basal ganglia is? What's a basal ganglia? Or no, I'm sorry, what's a ganglia? We had a definition of that. What's a ganglia? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so let's take a look at this. Basal ganglia. I have in parentheses here nuclei. The more common term, the more modern term is basal nuclei. Nuclei is plural, right? So one would be a basal nucleus, That would be proper terminology. Where would you find a basal nucleus? In the basal ganglia is in the peripheral nervous system, and a nucleus is in the central nervous system. And the basal nuclei are a special kind, a special group of gray matter things. And I see it on this slide. Here's a nice, what kind of view does this look like to you? What kind of transverse, sagittal, coronal? What separates anterior from posterior? That is a, frontal or coronal plane. Nice, all right? And so if we make that nice frontal cut, you see areas, white areas and gray areas in this section right here. This is of a real brain. All right, so here I see a white area. What can you tell me about this white area? What's happening here? Myelinated axons going someplace. That's all you know right at the moment. And then here I see some gray areas. We know here are some nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and this is where we find the basal nuclei. There's a number of them. I'll see your book calls it basal ganglia, but nobody ever does that anymore. Here are a number of them. Right? You don't have to know these different names, but as a group, you should know what they're called and what their function is. What lobe in the brain of the brain are they in? Frontal, and generally speaking, the frontal lobe is responsible for what kind of function? Motor. So these are involved with coordinating your movements, your motions, right? Particularly of your skeletal muscle. All right, so they control posture. The most important thing is they are inhibitory to skeletal muscles. They decrease muscle tone, which is kind of funny because usually when we think of the importance of a muscle, we think of contraction. But just as important a function is muscle relaxation. Remember, when a biceps contracts, a muscle has to relax. What's another muscle that has to relax? The triceps has to relax. If it doesn't relax, then you can't really move your arm. These muscles will be fighting against each other, and your motion is going to look really strange. That happens in a disease we call Parkinson's disease, when the basal nuclei are damaged, and they no longer can properly inhibit antagonistic muscles. So if somebody's moving, what does it look like when they're moving? Really weird, really staggered, because they're fighting all the muscles in their body. And their speech, is it going to be nice and smooth and fluid? No, it's going to be very disruptive, right? It's going to be very hard to understand them. So it's a disease of the efferent motor system. And when antagonistic muscles can't be forced into relaxation, right, then the motion is very staggered. And as a matter of fact, if you see somebody with Parkinson's disease, and you really don't know they have Parkinson's disease, and you don't listen to their, or even if you do listen to them speak, they sound like they're intoxicated on some kind of drug, right? Maybe alcohol or something like that. And they're like that all the time. What's your impression of somebody that is inebriated all the time? That they are a drug seeker, right? That they have a substance abuse problem. Well, guess what? Somebody with Parkinson's disease is not a substance abuser. They have that motor disability, right? And I think that's really important because if you're dealing with substance abusers later on in your life, then you kind of become concerned because you really never know what a substance abuser is going to do or how they're going to treat you, because what's the most important thing for them? To get the drug that they're dependent on, right? A lot of times they're more interested in that than their children and the health of other people around them. Right, so you're always concerned and you're protective of yourself. But if a person has Parkinson's disease, are you still concerned with that? No, not at all. Right, so your approach is going to be totally different, and so you have to be really careful that you don't treat a patient with Parkinson's disease as a substance abuser. Right, that would really be, you'd lose their admiration of you maybe for the rest of your life. Right, so be careful when you do that. So that's Parkinson's disease. Anybody know anybody with Parkinson's disease? Could be maybe not know them personally or heard of somebody with Parkinson's disease. Who's got Parkinson's? Yeah, who's got Parkinson's disease? Uh-huh. And when they move, how does it look? Really, really strange? Yeah, it's really hard to move around? Yeah, that's too bad. Sometimes it's progressive, unfortunately, to where a person really can't hardly move around at all anymore. Well, I think I asked that question because there's a famous actor that has Parkinson's disease. Michael J. Fox was exactly what I was thinking about. Okay, and I think it is progressing with him so that he has a lot of trouble moving around and speaking. And so there is damage to his basal nuclei,
right,
which is causing that. Well, it just so happens that sometimes these basal nuclei are damaged by drugs, illicit drugs, designer drugs that are not made by pharmaceutical companies, synthetic kinds of heroines and other kinds of chemicals that are not produced properly, and those chemicals go to receptors in these basal nuclei and destroy the receptors. Right? And that can produce an early onset of Parkinson's disease. And so everybody thought, since Michael J. Fox got Parkinson's disease at such a young age, that he was a substance abuser. And so he was asked constantly, well, what did you take? What kind of drugs were you taking back then? And he said, you know, I never was a substance abuser. I never took any drugs. And now we kind of believe him because there are a lot of child actors, a number of child actors in that show that he was on that came down with early onset Parkinson's disease as well. Does anybody know the name of that TV show? I think it's called Family Ties. Okay. And so now everybody thinks that probably a producer of a TV show laced the drinks of all the children to get them excited and awake during filming to keep them awake, and then later in life they came down with Parkinson's disease. So that's really a terrible thing that that could happen like that. All right, so basal nuclei, you don't want to call these ganglia anymore. We want to call them nuclei. What's their function? They control motion, right? Motor movements, skeletal muscle movements. All right, if we go way out here in the frontal lobe, right, we call this the prefrontal cortex. This is an interesting area. This is an area for what we call cognition. This is an area where we look around and appreciate the circumstance we find ourselves in. We get an impression of what the environment is like, what people are like, so that we can act appropriately. So if you're around friendly people, you act friendly. If you're around hostile people, then you protect yourself and kind of run away, right? If you're around really sassy people, well, then you might start being sassy back at them, right? So it just all depends on your surroundings. There's an interesting case where somebody had some severe damage to the frontal lobe. It didn't kill him, okay, but guess what it did? It changed his personality completely because he lost that really nice ability of cognition. And people in their psychology students study this case all the time. It's a little bit more appropriate in a psychology class. It happened to a guy called Phineas Gage. Does anybody know the story about Phineas Gage? Anybody ever hear of him? Yeah? All right, so you believe me, right? I'm not making this up. He was a railroad worker, right, laying railroad tracks a long time ago, and they used dynamite to clear the pathway to make the train tracks, and he drilled a hole to put the dynamite in, and then you stuff the dynamite down into the hole with a big, nice iron rod, right, you stick it down in there, and as he was packing the hole to blow up that mountainside, the dynamite went off, and guess what happened to the rod? It blew up, shot through his head, right between the sides of his mandible, up through his frontal cortex, and he survived, okay, but his personality changed. He was a very good, compliant worker, listened to orders, right, was very polite after that accident, showed up to work, right, very late, if at all, and caused trouble all the time because he lost that part of the frontal lobe. Right, so that's the prefrontal cortex. That's one important thing about the prefrontal cortex. Okay. All right, so here is the frontal. Here is a nice view of the temporal lobe. Then here's cerebellum, here's occipital, and then between occipital and frontal is the parietal lobes. All right, and here is a nice gyrus, here is a sulcus. Yeah, and sulci contain blood vessels. Okay. Parietal lobe. Let's talk about parietal lobes for a little bit. That's the primary sensory cortex on the surface of your body. So sometimes we call that on the surface of your body somatic. Since skeletal muscles are more or less on the surface of your body, they're not deep inside body cavities. That's why we call that nervous system that goes to skeletal muscles the somatic motor, somatic nervous system. Okay. So on the surface of your body, if it's sensation, we call that somatic sensation. And the parietal lobe is responsible for that. So if we take a brain and we stimulate some part of the brain in the parietal lobe, what's gonna be the experience of that person? Is he going to move? Okay, if we excite the parietal lobe, what's the function of the parietal lobe? Sensory. Okay, will he move if we stimulate the parietal lobe? The answer is no, right? What's going to happen? They will sense something, like touch, pressure, pain, on the surface of their body. And depending on what part of the parietal lobe, then a different part of their body will have a sensation of feeling that particular stimulus, whether it's pain or pressure or temperature. Parietal lobe. I'm going to get a little more detail on that in just a little bit. Temporal lobe, we said, was sensory, but for hearing. The primary auditory cortex is right where I'm circling right about now, kind of in the posterior part of the temporal lobe, way back over here, allows you to hear. Or if this part is stimulated, right, if we took some electrodes and stimulated this part of a person's brain, what would be their experience? They would hear something. Yeah, they would hear something. Probably wouldn't be a symphony or anything, but they would hear something. If we stimulated this part of the brain, where I have the cursor now, the occipital lobe, what would be a person's experience? Vision. Yeah, they'd see something. Okay, and if we stimulated this part of the parietal lobe, what would be the experience? Yeah, they would feel something on the surface of their body. And depending on what area it was, it would be a different area on the surface of the body. All right, well, now let's go to the frontal lobe. If we stimulated some part of the frontal lobe, what would happen to that person? What is the function of that frontal lobe? It is motor area. So if we stimulate some part of the frontal lobe, what's going to happen to that person? Some part of their body is going to move. And depending on what area of the frontal lobe was stimulated, a different region of their body would move. All right, so that's really important. For instance, if somebody has a brain tumor and a surgeon wants to go in and get that brain tumor out, then they want to know exactly where that brain tumor is and how close it is to these motor pathways or sensory pathways, especially motor pathways, because you don't want to destroy a pathway right to somebody's mouth, because then they won't be able to eat again. Or, and you don't want to destroy a pathway to somebody's occipital lobe, because then you would cause blindness right away. So all of these different functions of the brain is really important to know about and where they actually exist. Okay, occipital lobe, sensory areas for vision. There's one important area for vision, right, that has to do with speech, and it's called Wernicke's area. Right, for speech comprehension, its ability to recognize and understand spoken words. And that area is right between the temporal lobe, Wernicke's area is right between the temporal lobe and the occipital lobe, right in this area right here. So you probably would guess that vision, right, has a lot to do with speech processing and understanding language. And that is true. Looking at facial expression, looking at somebody's lips and what they're doing with their body, all contributes to your understanding of language. In what area of the brain is important for understanding language? That was Wernicke's area. What part of the brain? Sorry? It's part of the occipital lobe over here. Yeah, it's not the primary visual cortex, but it's what we call an association area, anterior to that primary area. And the name of that area is called Wernicke's area. What's the area that's not responsible for understanding language, but for speaking language? That's a motor function, so that's in the frontal lobe, and that's called Broca's area. Okay. I'll show you where those areas are in just a little bit. But I had a slide, a really nice slide, not too long ago. All right, maybe I'll show you this right now. Okay. So here we see a nice, not really a cross-section, but we took a chunk out of somebody's brain, right? Here we see a gyrus and a sulcus goes down pretty deep inside the brain, and then you see some dark area. What do we call this dark area? Okay. Here's a fissure, this deep indentation, but I'm really concerned about this dark area right here. What do we call this dark area that is? Yeah, that's gray matter, and now you know what it's made of. What is this gray matter made of? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Right? And then you have this white matter here. What's the white matter for? Yeah, it's got myelinated axon. It's got tracts. Okay. Well, here are the four different regions, four different lobes of the cerebrum. And the last thing I'm going to point out to you is that here is the sulcus that separates the frontal right lobe from the parietal lobe, and since it separates these two, we call that the central sulcus. That's the only important sulcus that I want you to know about. The gyrus that's right in front of it is called the precentral gyrus, and the one below it is the postcentral. And so now you now know the function of this precentral gyrus. It is controlling skeletal muscles in your body, because that's the motor part of your brain. And the postcentral gyrus is responsible for sensation on the surface of your body, right? Just on either side of that central sulcus right there. All right, so we're going to start with these different kinds of tracts, different kinds of fibers next time in class.